I want you to picture a split screen right now. On the left side, you're inside a very plush, mahogany-paneled conference room in Washington. The air probably smells like expensive coffee and apparently a $1 billion entry fee. This is the inaugural meeting of something called the Board of Peace.
Which honestly sounds like a cover charge that would make even a tech oligarch blink.
Yeah.
$1 billion just to pull up a chair.
Right. But then look at the screen on the right. We're in the Middle East. The air smells like jet fuel and desert dust. The United States is currently parking the largest fleet of heavy bombers in that region since the invasion of Iraq in 2003.
Yeah, it creates such a jarring contrast. You have this checkbook diplomacy happening on one side of the globe and a very kinetic steel and fire reality building up on the other.
And that paradox is exactly where we need to start this morning. Welcome to your deep dive into frontpage.world. It is Thursday, February 19, 2026.
Let's get into it.
I'm ready to unpack this because the headlines today are just, they're screaming mixed signals. Our mission today is a full tour of the globe's major newspapers.
And we have a massive stack of sources to get through today. We're pulling from The Wall Street Journal, Le Monde, zooming over to The Times of India, Jungang Ilbo in Korea, and all the way down to the Sydney Morning Herald.
It is a true global tour for you today. We've got this bizarre peace war split with the Trump administration, a massive tech feud involving Anthropic and the Pentagon, and some serious accountability moments for world leaders.
Oh, absolutely. Including a British royal in handcuffs, which, well, you don't see that every century.
Yeah, plus we have a corn lady in Botswana who is teaching the world a master class in personal branding and dignity.
I love that story.
I do too. But we have to eat our geopolitical vegetables before we get to the corn. Let's talk about this Board of Peace. This is dominating the front pages of the Wall Street Journal and Le Monde. President Trump held the first meeting yesterday. Who was actually in the room for this?
It was the inner circle you'd expect. Vice President J.D. Vance was there. Jared Kushner was front and center. But the detail that really elevates this from a standard, political advisory meeting to something entirely different comes from Le Monde.
Right, the Davos connection.
Exactly. They dug into the charter that was apparently signed back in Davos. The reporting suggests that to secure a permanent seat on this board, there's a potential ticket of entry of $1 billion.
Hold on, though. Is this a government advisory board or is it a fundraising gala? Because usually you don't pay $1 billion just to give advice. That implies you're buying something.
And that is the critical question the European papers are asking right now.
Yeah.
If you're a foreign entity or a massive conglomerate putting up $1 billion, you likely expect a return on that investment.
Like policy influence, access, deregulation.
Precisely. It blurs the line between statecraft and a private equity deal. It signals a privatization of diplomacy that we haven't really seen on this scale before.
So while the checkbooks are opening in DC, the Bombay doors are opening in the Middle East. The Financial Times and the WSJ are painting a very different picture of U.S. foreign policy than the one we see in that boardroom.
The hardware movement is undeniable. We aren't just talking about a few drones being repositioned. We are talking about F-35s, F-22 Raptors, and the B-2 Spirit stealth bombers.
The heavy hitters.
The heaviest. The FT makes a point to say this is the most significant air power buildup since 2003. That is not a peacekeeping force. That is an offensive strike package.
And there's a timeline attached to this, right? Because Trump didn't just say, we're watching Iran. He gave a deadline.
10 days. He told the Board of Peace that within 10 days, we will know if there's a deal with Iran or if the U.S. takes alternative measures.
10 days, that is incredibly specific and incredibly short. I mean, that's next week.
It's a pressure cooker strategy. He's claiming the 2025 strikes decimated Iran's nuclear potential, but he insists now that they cannot have a weapon, period. And naturally, the markets are reacting to that 10-day clock.
Yeah, I saw Brent crude jump 6%. It's sitting over $72 a barrel this morning.
Oil markets are the ultimate lie detector for geopolitical risk. When traders see B-2 bombers and hear 10 days, they buy futures. But there's a diplomatic snag here that I think is even more significant than the oil price.
You're talking about the British bases?
Yes, the FT is reporting that the UK is hesitant to let the US use British bases for this potential operation. We're talking about RAF Fairford in England, which is crucial for B-2 deployments because of its runway length and support facilities, and Diego Garcia in the Indian Ocean.
Diego Garcia is huge strategically. That's the unsinkable aircraft carrier for that entire region. If the
Yeah.
UK says no, does that stop the US?
It doesn't stop them, no, but it complicates the logistics immensely. It forces the U.S. to rely on longer flight paths or different allies. But more importantly, it signals a fracture in the special relationship.
Right. If the U.K. is sitting this one out, it undermines the legitimacy of the operation globally. It turns it from a coalition into a U.S. solo act.
Exactly. So we have 10 days on the clock, a fractured alliance, and a billion-dollar peace board watching it all unfold.
Okay, while everyone is watching the missiles, I want to pivot to the money. Because looking at the Japan Times today, the real alliances are being forged with checkbooks, not just fighter jets.
You're looking at that $550 billion number.
$500 trillion. This is Japan's investment commitment to the U.S. And they aren't just buying treasury bonds, they are building physical hardware.
This is a massive shift. We're moving from purely military alliances to deep structural economic integration. There are two headline projects here from the first round. One is a $33 billion natural gas plant in Ohio,
which is going to be the world's largest, apparently, which is huge for energy independence. But the one that caught my eye and frankly confused me a bit at first is the factory in Georgia, synthetic diamonds.
This is the fascinating one. Now, when you hear diamonds, you probably think engagement rings or maybe drill bits. But in the tech world, diamonds are a utility. They are not a luxury.
They're for semiconductors, right?
They are the ultimate heat sink. As chips get more powerful for AI, for military tech, they run hotter. Heat is the absolute enemy of computing power. Diamond is one of the best materials on Earth for dissipating that heat. It's also used in advanced optics and sensors.
So this isn't about jewelry at all. It's about national security supply chains.
100%. Right now, Japan relies on a single country for over 50% of its industrial diamonds, and you can probably guess who that is.
It starts with a C and ends with Hina.
You got it. China completely dominates the synthetic diamond market. By building this factory in Georgia, Japan is trying to friendshore that supply chain. They are decoupling from China and integrating with the U.S. industrial base.
It's a strategic move disguised as a local factory opening. And speaking of China, China Daily has a front page message from President Xi regarding the Spring Festival and the Year of the Horse.
Vigor and resilience. That's the core message. Xi is acknowledging the complex global environment, which is diplomatic code for trade wars and military tension, but signaling that China intends to just gallop forward.
They're going to need that resilience because the resource war isn't just about diamonds or oil anymore. It's about land. There is a wild story in the Wall Street Journal about Northern Virginia. It's basically AI versus the American dream.
This is the clearest example I've seen of the digital world cannibalizing the physical world. Northern Virginia is the data center capital of the planet.
Something like 70% of the world's internet traffic flows through there, right?
Exactly. And AI is thirsty. It needs more servers, more power, and more land. So here's the setup. A home builder had acquired a massive plot of land for about $50 million. The plan was to build homes, which people desperately need in that corridor.
And then Amazon walks in.
Amazon walks in with a check for $700 million.
$700 million against $50 million. That's not even a negotiation. That's a steamroller.
When the profit margin for AI is that high, the housing market just can't compete. So the houses don't get built. The land becomes a server farm. We're literally trading bedrooms for bandwidth.
That is deeply dystopian. Sorry you can't live here. The chatbot needs a condo.
It segues perfectly into our next topic, actually. Because while AI is eating up land, the companies building it are getting into a messy fight with the people who defend the land, the Pentagon.
This is the WSJ piece on Anthropic. They're the company behind Claude, one of the big competitors to OpenAI. They've always positioned themselves as the safe, ethical AI company.
Right. And that ethical stance is colliding hard with military reality. The Pentagon wants to use AI for all lawful purposes. In military speak, that includes offensive cyber operations, weapons targeting, lethality.
And Anthropic is saying, no thanks.
They're saying, let's put some guardrails on this. They are hesitant to let their models be used for direct kill chains or offensive strikes. And this hesitation is actually costing them capital.
The article mentions a venture firm, 1789 Capital.
This is key. 1789 Capital explicitly markets itself as an anti-woke or patriotic investment firm. They refuse to invest in Anthropic specifically because of these ideological reasons.
So they see safety guardrails as woke obstructionism.
Essentially, yes. They cited Anthropic's leadership having too many critics of the Trump administration. We're seeing the true politicization of code here. We're moving toward a world where we have red AI and blue AI, and they might not talk to each other.
That's terrifying for interoperability, but hey, at least Anthropic is actually building AI. Unlike the folks at Galgosha's University in India, did you see the robot dog story in the Times of India?
I did. This is the comic relief we needed today, though it's a bit painful to read. So this university is at a major AI expo in New Delhi. They unveil their cutting-edge innovation, a robot dog they named Greave.
Grieve. Sounds intimidating.
It looked impressive until people realized it was just a Unitree G2. That's a Chinese robot dog you can literally buy online for a couple of thousand dollars.
Wait, they didn't even 3D print a new shell for it. They just peeled off the sticker.
They just put their own sticker on a mass-market Chinese robot that got kicked out of the expo, obviously.
It's funny, but it also feels like a symptom of a much deeper problem.
It is. The pressure to appear innovative is so high right now. Governments and universities are throwing money at AI, demanding breakthroughs. When you demand a breakthrough on a schedule, sometimes you get people peeling stickers off toys just to have something to show.
Fake it till you make it, robot edition. But while some are faking tech, others are actively trying to ban it, specifically for kids. This story in the FAZ out of Germany feels like a real tipping point.
This is moving incredibly fast globally. The Prime Minister of Schleswig-Holstein, Daniel Günther, is pushing for a total ban on social media for anyone under 16.
Not parental controls, a total ban.
A hard ban. And his reasoning is blunt. He cites horror films on timelines, AI-controlled communication, and the mental health toll. He's essentially saying that the experiment has failed and parents can no longer fight the algorithm alone.
It's the duty of care argument. If a physical product is unsafe for kids, you recall it. If an app is unsafe,
You ban it, at least for minors. And the WSJ notes this is going viral globally. From Paris to New Delhi, Australia led the charge last fall, and now it's everywhere. The move fast and break things era is over when it involves kids' mental health.
governments are stepping in as the super parent. Speaking of governments stepping in, let's talk about accountability. Because normally, we hear about leaders getting away with things. Today's front pages are full of the exact opposite.
It's Judgment Day in a few capitals. The biggest one is in South Korea. Jungang Ilbo is reporting on the first trial verdict for former President Yoon Suk-yeol.
This is regarding the martial law declaration from back in 2024.
Yes, the 12.3 emergency martial law. It's been 443 days since that event. He's facing a charge of insurrection.
Insurrection. That is a heavy word for a former head of state.
It carries massive historical weight. The legal battle here is fascinating. His defense is that declaring martial law was a governing act to maintain order. The prosecution argues it was an act of rebellion to disrupt the Constitution. They are literally debating the legal line between ruling and rebelling.
And while Yoon is in court, the UK has a royal in a cell, Prince Andrew.
Or, as the police blotter calls him now, Andrew Mountbatten Windsor.
That name drop is significant. It strips away the HRH completely.
It makes him a citizen. He was arrested at Sandringham. The charge is misconduct in public office, tied to his days as a trade envoy and his connections to Jeffrey Epstein. The FT points out this is historic, the first arrest of a senior royal since King Charles I.
And we know how that ended for Charles I during the Civil War.
He lost his head. Andrew is just losing his freedom, potentially. But it shows that the Epstein fallout is far from over.
It's happening in Spain, too. El País reports on a massive scandal in national police.
The DAO, basically the second in command of the entire police force, resigned over a sexual aggression scandal. But now the heat is rising to the Minister of Interior. The allegation is that they knew about it and tried to hush it up to protect the image of the police.
And in Italy, the president himself had to step in.
President Mattarella. Corriere della Sera covers this. He attended a meeting of the High Council of the Judiciary, which he almost never does. He had to demand respect between institutions because the Meloni government has been attacking magistrates, calling them a paramafia system.
Wow, paramafia.
It's a global theme today.
Yeah.
The executive branch versus the judicial branch. Politicians versus the law. Whether it's Korea, the UK, Spain, or Italy, the courts are becoming the battlefield where these power struggles play out.
It feels like the institutions are creaking under the pressure, which brings me to the stories that aren't about institutions, but about people. Because when the systems fail, people seem to step up. Or tragically, they suffer.
We have to acknowledge the tragedy in New York City first. The New York Times reports 20 people died in a freeze.
In one of the wealthiest cities in the world.
It highlights the absolute paralysis on climate policy. The Trump administration has halted greenhouse gas regulations, so you have this void. The NYT points out that states like California, Colorado, and Virginia are rushing to pass their own climate laws to fill that gap.
But a freeze doesn't respect state lines. It's a patchwork solution to a global crisis. And speaking of failing to protect people, the Sydney Morning Herald has a story out of Broken Hill in Australia that is infuriating.
This is a classic case of bureaucratic erasure. Broken Hill is a mining town with high lead contamination levels. There was a draft report that explicitly recommended relocating childcare centers away from the high-risk zones.
Sensible. Get the kids away from the lead.
But in the final report, that recommendation was deleted, completely censored.
So we knew the kids were in danger, they wrote down the solution, and then someone just hit backspace.
It's a dereliction of duty. It's the system protecting mining interests rather than the children.
Okay, I need something to lift us out of this. Let's go to Gaza. The New York Times has a story about Academies of Hope.
This is the resilience we were talking about. Dr. David Hassan, a Palestinian-American neurosurgeon, have gone into the rubble and set up secret tent schools for war orphans.
There's a description of the entrance in the Pisa Gate with a bright red cartoon race car.
It's such a jarring, beautiful image. A cartoon car in the middle of a war zone. But it signals to the kids that they are safe there. They can be a child there. There's a quote from a 12-year-old girl that just floored me. She said, "The best thing is holding a pencil again."
It's just holding a pencil. It's control. It's a future.
It grounds you. And we have one more story of someone taking control of their future against all odds. The Corn Lady of Botswana.
Chifisa Marumo. I absolutely love this arc.
She's a university grad. She did everything right, but couldn't find a job in her field. So out of sheer necessity, she started selling ears of corn door to door.
And people mocked her for it.
Relentlessly. A professor, someone who should have been a mentor, nicknamed her Corn Lady as an insult. Like, look how far you've fallen.
But she didn't hide from it.
No. She leaned all the way in. She turned that roadside stall into a brand. She built a massive social media following. She became a fashion icon, posing with her corn. She took the insult and made it her empire.
It's about dignity. Whether you're coding AI or selling corn, if you own the labor, there is dignity in it.
Exactly. The system failed her. The economy didn't have a job for her, so she built her own system.
So here we are. We've got billion-dollar peace tickets, fake robot dogs, skyrocketing oil prices, and a corn lady conquering Botswana. What is the through line here for you?
I think the through line today is warning signs.
How so?
Well, there's a small story in the New York Times today about an avalanche in California. Tragically, 15 skiers were caught in it.
I saw that, yeah.
The thing is, the warnings were posted. The danger rating was high. The red flags were literally flying on the mountain. Everyone knew the slope was unstable. But 15 people went out anyway.
They thought they could beat the odds.
Or they just ignored the signal entirely. And I think that's the perfect metaphor for our world right now. We have climate warnings in New York. We have conflict warnings in the Middle East with that 10-day clock. We have mental health warnings for our kids on social media. The signs are posted everywhere.
The red flags are flying.
The question is, are we going to read them and change course? Or are we going to ski right into the storm because we think the rules don't apply to us?
That is the question to carry with you today. Are you reading the signs? That's it for this deep dive into frontpage.world.
See you tomorrow for the next front page.